Space, time, and matter. The mysterious forces of nature. What is gravity? All the symbols representing all the elements around us. Bright minds known as theoretical physicists. Everything falls to Earth with the same acceleration.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Howard Burton, Executive Director of Perimeter Institute, and it's a pleasure to welcome you to the Fireside Chat edition of our most recent public event. In this, the United Nations International Year of Physics, in honor of the 100th anniversary of Einstein's miraculous year in 1905, we, as many other institutions and organizations around the world, are paying tribute to Albert Einstein, his legacy, and the wonderful effects that he has created, not only throughout the world of theoretical physics, but also beyond. Tonight, it is truly an honor and a privilege to have three eminent individuals, all associated with Einstein and his work, but all representing three different frameworks and three different perspectives. To my far right, we have Lee Smolin, Professor Lee Smolin. Professor Smolin received his PhD from Harvard University and had professorial positions at Yale and Syracuse and Penn State before coming to Perimeter to be a founding researcher, long-term researcher at Perimeter Institute, which makes us all very pleased and very proud. Lee has made numerous contributions to numerous different areas of theoretical physics, and his interests range from foundations of quantum theory and cosmology, even to complexity theory, and far beyond. But perhaps his most noted achievements have been in the field of quantum gravity, where he is one of the originators and developers of loop quantum gravity. Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Lee Smolin.
Thank you.
To Lee's left, we have Professor John Moffat. Professor Moffat received his PhD from Cambridge University and took up research positions at CERN and Imperial College, as well as the Research Institute for Advanced Study in Maryland, before becoming a professor at the University of Toronto, where he spent the lion's share of his research years. We're delighted to have Professor John Moffat here as a researcher at Perimeter Institute as well. Professor Moffat's research interests include gravitation, cosmology, foundations of quantum theory, and he is a noted expert in all of those areas. As well, Professor Moffat brings a different perspective, having had some interaction with Albert Einstein in his youth, which played, as he will doubtless tell you, a formative part in his development as a physicist. Ladies and gentlemen, Professor John Moffat. And to my immediate right is Professor John Stachel. He was the most laid-back member of our trio. Professor Stachel received his PhD from the Stevens Institute of Technology, and he had positions at Lehigh University, University of Pittsburgh, and spent the lion's share of his career at Boston University, where he not only contributed in theoretical physics and gravitation, but also played seminal roles in the development and the history of science and philosophy. He's got very, very wide-ranging interests and views and perspectives. Professor Stachel is also the director of the Boston University Center for Einstein Studies, and he is truly one of the world's greatest Einstein scholars. So we are delighted to have him, and it should be said parenthetically that, however esteemed and remarkable the colleagues are to his right, I trust Professor Stachel on anything related to Einstein more than any of these other two guys. Professor John Stachel.
I want to say first, it's a tremendous honor to be here with John and John, who are both people that have inspired me and that I admire very much. So I'm only starting off because I have the least to say. In the period of roughly 1900 to 1910, there was begun a scientific revolution Scientific revolutions don't happen very often. Major scientific revolutions, when our whole conception of what nature is, of what space is, of what time is, of what it means to describe something in nature, of what motion is, our understandings change fundamentally. The last one was the Copernican Revolution, that was from the publication of Copernicus's book to the publication of Newton's book, establishing what we call Newtonian physics. And that took 140 years, ending, I think, in 1687. Yeah.
First edition.
See, he really is a scholar. And Einstein started this current revolution, and he started it 100 years ago by, in the same year, and this is why we celebrate this year, proposing the special theory of relativity. He was also the first person to realize, to my unscholarly understanding, that there had to be a new physics of quantum physics, starting off with the theory of light. And he was the first person to make a definitive argument that matter was made up of atoms. And he did all those things in 1 year, starting the revolution that we're in. Now, the previous one took 140 years. It's 100 years through the present one. And unfortunately, we're not done yet, even though there's probably a factor of 100 or 1,000 times more physicists now than there were then. We're not actually going any faster through this. And so the main legacy of Einstein is as the founder of a revolution that people like all of us here, myself, many of us at Perimeter Institute, are working to finish. To finish, we have to understand fully the threads that Einstein started, relativity theory, and then the general theory of relativity, which he invented then in 1915, 1916. And quantum theory, we have to understand them and we have to put them together, which, for example, my own work has largely been devoted to. So he is the founder of a revolution in progress, and as such, he and his influence stands over everything that we do. He also is a very important person to somebody like myself in theoretical physics because he showed us what one creative and rebellious individual can do. And I'm sure that this will come out. Einstein was not a person who was part of a big movement. Einstein was not a part of a community. He was his own person to begin with. His ideas were taken up and used and are part of science now, but he was never himself in the mainstream of science, as I think my colleagues will bring out. He was always somebody who was fiercely independent, whose creativity and whose moral sense of what counted for knowledge and for clarity of understanding put him outside the community of fellow seekers because, frankly speaking, his standards were higher and he demanded more of himself and of us. So he stands as a symbol of what you can accomplish through creativity and independence. And he also is a little scary because, at least I know very well, and I'm sure this will come up, so I'll deal with this right now. Were Einstein still here, what would he think of what I do now? Not much. And the reason is that he didn't think that the quantum theory, which is what most of physics is now based on and what all of us do, and I see Ramon is there and other people are there, what we all spend our time doing, Einstein didn't believe it. It wasn't good enough for him. And for him, the main task was to go beyond quantum theory. And very few of us have the courage, even now, to follow him in that direction. So Einstein stands as an inspiration, and also it's a little bit scary. One person by himself who couldn't even initially get a job in physics was able to do more in a few years than most of the rest of us have done since. And that's impressive and frightening. And we look to him for inspiration. How did you do it? And another role he plays, at least in the life of myself and people like me, is a kind of imaginary mentor. When I was younger, I used to wonder, what would he think? Kind of, you know, what would Jesus think? Well, who knows where that is, but you know, I used to think, what would Einstein think of this? And I still do. And the answer isn't too good. So having said that, I think I'll turn it over to...
Over to you, John.
To me, the most revolutionary paper, which I will come back to later, is the paper on the so-called photoelectric effect. And this paper had to do with the transformation of light. And this was the big idea. And it was dismissed by his peers. And it took years before experimental physics could determine that he was right, and he was right. And these are the three marks of a great revolution in physics. And it doesn't happen very often, obviously. So of the five papers, I think this was the most revolutionary, because his idea was that light consisted of quantums of energy, the frequency of the light times Planck's constant H. And the Planck's constant H came from, of course, the father of quantum physics in 1900, Max Planck. And idea that light was consisted of corpuscles of energy was totally revolutionary. And Max Planck, his boss, didn't like it, never liked it, really. And Millikan, the American physicist who did the experiments in 1916 to prove, to verify issues of the so-called photoelectric effect, didn't like it either, even though the data showed that Einstein was right. So it wasn't until 1921 that Stockholm decided to give Einstein a Nobel Prize, and they didn't recognize relativity, and they didn't like his corpuscular theory of light, so they compromised in giving him the Nobel Prize for this paper. So this is a true mark of originality. Of course, when we come to the gravitational theory, this is quite revolutionary, because the basic idea was that matter affects the geometry of space-time. And this is an amazing concept. So he also had the idea of the principle of equivalence. That is, if you are freely falling in a gravitational field, you can't tell the difference between an acceleration and a gravitational field. And the anecdote is that, which I learned recently, is that around 1905, 1907, according to a talk he gave in Tokyo some years later about his work, relativity, he said he was sitting in a chair in Bern, and he had this idea of a man falling off a roof. And he thought, well, if he's falling off a roof, he can't feel gravity. So he was so astonished, he almost fell out of his chair.
Don't try it.
Don't try it. No, I won't propose you do this. So this gets to the key of Einstein and the way he thought about physics.
Thank you very much, John. Of course, if the roof is high enough and you've fallen off a roof, you might not feel anything at all. Over to John Stachel to give us his views.
Thank you, Howard, for inviting me. I'm glad to finally met my Waterloo. I think one of the hardest problems I find in speaking to people who are not physicists to get from the myths about Einstein, which are so prevalent, back to the man. So I'm going to take you at breakneck speed. Fortunately, we can't go faster than the speed of light, Einstein assures us, but I'll take you pretty fast through a talk, which I usually do in a more leisurely way, but just to throw out some ideas that we can then discuss later on at your pleasure. Well, the first myth about Einstein is he was born old. When you say Einstein, this is the picture that almost immediately comes to people's mind. But of course, he was a child. He had parents. But here's another myth, that not only old, but sort of the dotty-looking old man. This was actually supposed to be the original cover for the catalog about Einstein, which is for the exhibit that's going to open in Berlin very shortly. Well, if it's just his sister, we'll point out his sister. And this is the one they finally decided on, which makes him look a bit sinister, I think. But another myth there, Einstein, chief engineer of the universe. Now, what does that mean? This is an older drawing from the New Yorker. People are accustoming themselves to the idea that the physical states of science itself were the final physical reality. there's the man in the street accustoming himself to that idea. Again, the idea that Einstein's theories are incomprehensible to the ordinary person. I could discuss the question of what did Einstein do? How should we characterize it? Is discovery, is it creation, invention? Einstein said invention, and I agree. Well, here's the Einstein we should think about, the mature man looking neither dotty nor youthful, but a mature creative figure. He spoke about three basic ideas which characterize his fundamental life's work. We could talk about these. One of them is the one that led to the special theory of relativity. One of them is the one that led to the general theory of relativity, which has to do with the Galileo and the Leaning Tower of Pisa, the principle of equivalence, the Einstein elevator, what that can lead us to, and then the final quest of his life, to find a unified field theory. So we could talk about any of these things. But let's turn to his social views. My passionate sense of social justice and social responsibility has always contrasted, oddly, with my pronounced lack of need for direct contact with other human beings and human communities. I'm truly a lone traveler. Einspanner really means a horse that is yoked alone. And I have never belonged to my country, my home, or even my immediate family with whole heart. In the face of all these ties, I have never lost a sense of distance and the need for solitude, feelings which increased with the years. And indeed, I don't think this is characteristic of the young Einstein. He himself tended to read the young Einstein in light of the old, which a problem we all have, but it certainly does characterize the older Einstein. However, that he did feel passionately about these things is also shown by this letter he wrote in 1938 to his sister. The great political events, this is in the time of Munich, remember, when it looks like Chamberlain comes back from Munich, remember, waving this piece of paper, which says his agreement with Hitler is giving us peace in our time. But Einstein knew better. He knew this was the beginning of the Second World War, actually. He says the great political events of our time are so disheartening that one feels quite isolated in his own generation. It is as if people have lost the passion for justice and honor and no longer prize what better generations have won through indescribably courageous self-sacrifice. The foundation of all human values is precisely morality. So seeing this clearly in primitive times is the pure greatness of our Moses. He's speaking to his sister as one Jew to another. Just look at the contrast with our contemporaries. And what I want to focus on in the remaining minute or two is Einstein's pinpointing the military mentality as early as 1947, 2 years after the end of the Second World War and just at the beginning of the Cold War. He said it's characteristic of the military mentality that non-human factors, atom bombs, strategic bases, weapons of all sorts, are held essential, while the human being, his or her, I would say, desires and thoughts, in short, the psychological factors are considered as unimportant and secondary. He points out what happened to Germans when they adopted this military mentality. They were ruined within less than 100 years, both first morally by fascism, then militarily by the aftermath of World War II. When he came to the United States, he severed all ties with Germany, but he came to feel, as he says, that his new homeland was embarking on the same path. I must frankly confess that the foreign policy of the United States since the termination of hostilities has reminded me sometimes irresistibly of the foreign policy of Germany under Kaiser Wilhelm II. Not fascism, but militarism is what he's focusing about here. With remarkable prescience, he forecast putting together the military mentality with the new atomic bombs, the kind of things that we were going to be led to. Preventive wars, does that sound familiar? Sacrifices of citizen civil rights, political witch hunting, control of teaching and research, of the press, and so forth. A reappraisal of all traditional values gradually takes place, and anything that does not clearly serve the utopian goal of militarism is regarded as and treated as inferior. Utopia, in other words, this is not just a bad policy. This is a bad policy that's not going to work. It's going to lead to destruction, first of our own country, well, my own country, I shouldn't speak for your country, first of my own country, and then of the world, if something's not done. Well, here I remark on how I read the current situation. This is not a left-right issue, that I want to point this out, too. I have a colleague at Boston University who's a former military man, a retired colonel. He's in the International Affairs Department, and I think he was appointed by the president of our university because he is a right-wing conservative figure. But he is a true conservative, not a neoconservative. And he is extremely worried about what is happening and points out that in this way the right and the left are coming together. We both are trying to prevent my country from going down the road to disaster. I haven't got time to give you any details, but here are a few quotes from his article, which I'm happy to say was published in the Bostonian magazine, our Boston University magazine. He's written a book on the new American militarism, which is well worth your attention. I'll just conclude with two lessons from two great Americans of our past. I'll read the second one first. Thomas Jefferson, speaking about slavery, said, "I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that his justice cannot sleep forever." And how are we going to get out of this situation? Here we must think of what Frederick Douglass has taught us, a black former slave who went from slavery to freedom. That's the title of his autobiography. The lesson he drew is, without struggle, there is no progress. Yes, what is happening to the American people today can be reversed, but without struggle, it will not be reversed. And through his writings and the force of his moral example, Albert Einstein stands at our side in this struggle. I close with a quote from Lessing on Klopstock, who you probably know, but you don't know. He wrote the text of Handel's Messiah. Who wouldn't praise the Klopstock? Who'd rather be praised less and read more? Who wouldn't praise an Einstein? Let's praise him less and read him more. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Thank you very much, John, for that whirlwind tour. That must have been a difficult lecture to follow, even in normal speed.
Give me an hour, and I'll convince you otherwise.
Maybe I can ask you a question, since you spent so much time on the social impact that Einstein has had. So here is this theoretical physicist who has made all these breathtaking discoveries and who has captivated and overturned the world of physics, and yet becomes this icon in the public consciousness. Even today, 50 years after his death, there's this notion of Einstein as the acme of intellectual achievement. How did that come about? How did this notion of Einstein having such influence over the political sphere and the social sphere and all of humanity so that people would seek out his opinions, people would consult him, he would have a platform for his views of everything from passivism to social constructs and so forth. How did that happen when it certainly wasn't a regular thing that happened to all physicists or all scientists?
No, there's two aspects of it. First of all, why did Einstein change? As a young man, he was quite uninterested in politics. It seems to have been the First World War that brought about the change. He, remember, moved to Berlin in 1914, just on the eve of the Guns of August, and he was there stranded in Berlin, the capital of German militarism, at a time when he saw all of these militaristic, jingoistic passions unleashed. And what really shocked him was to see how intellectuals and scientists that he respected were carried along by this tide, people whom he thought, because of their educational advantages, should have been able to resist. So this is what brought him to first think deeply about politics, and from then on, he became more and more engaged. After the war, of course, came the famous English Eclipse Expedition, which verified a prediction of the general theory of relativity, which has been alluded to previously, the idea that light rays would be deflected if they passed near the near the limb of the sun on their way to the Earth by the gravitational attraction of the Earth. This was a prediction of his theory which was verified to great public hoopla in 1919, and this gave Einstein a platform. He now realized he had celebrity, and he was able to use that celebrity to get across his ideas in a way that he wouldn't ordinarily have done so. Now, why he then became this mythic figure, this figure in the process of becoming a myth that we live with today, it's hard to say. I've seen many explanations given, but none of them is fully satisfactory. But the fact is that Einstein realized he had this ability to capture the public press and opinion because of this celebrity, and he used that, he felt he used it wisely. He did not, sometimes he's portrayed as a bleeding heart who would support any cause if you just appealed to him, his sympathies sufficiently strongly. This is not true. He chose his causes carefully, and he tried to limit the use of his influence, of his ability to speak out, because he felt his influence would be wasted if he just spoke out on everything.
I want to make a personal comment about Einstein, a personal story, which I think brings out the humanity of the man. When I was about 19 in Copenhagen, I took to doing physics and mathematics. So within a year, I studied Einstein's work on unified theory, and no one in physics was interested in that at the time. As usual, he was way ahead of his time. And so I wrote a paper criticizing some of his work. I mean, this is what you do when you're 19 years old. And sent it to Einstein in Princeton, and I thought, well, I'll never hear about this. Who am I? And lo and behold, I get back a letter from Albert Einstein in German. So my German was not up to scratch, so I rushed to my barber down the street that was German. I said, can you read this? This is a, I rushed in and said, I have a letter from Albert Einstein. So he translated it, and then I wrote back to Einstein, criticizing what he thought about my paper, and he wrote back. And I also threw in some Greek philosophy. And so this went on, and then finally he wrote a letter in which he set forth how what he thought about physics at the time. It was an essay. And he, for example, said that he did not think the gravitational field should be quantized and gave the reasons why. Anyway, Niels Bohr got to hear about this at the Bohr Institute, the famous physicist Niels Bohr. So he invited me to the Institute to talk to me. He wanted to know what Einstein was up to. So we talked for 2 hours. And finally, Einstein said, you know...
Bohr said,
you know, Moffat, you're wasting your time. Albert's doing this unified theory. It's a waste of time and a waste of physicists' time. And then he chuckled. And he said, you know, Einstein is an alchemist. So to quickly finish, I went to England, and then I was sent around to professors to see whether I was a genuine article. And I went to Dublin to visit Erwin Schrödinger, famous physicist in quantum mechanics. And we talked about Einstein and his work. And Schrödinger was working on the unified field theory. So these are the two great figures, two of the great figures of 20th century physics, were both working on this subject. And Schrödinger had a strong disagreement with Einstein about how things should develop with this unified theory. So he got really exasperated with me. He says, Moffat, you're doing what Einstein is doing. I said, yes, well, he said, Einstein is a fool. So I was quite taken aback, and I thought, Niels Bohr called him an alchemist, and Professor Schrödinger calls him a fool. And I thought, how can this possibly be? Because he's the great physicist of the 20th century. Anyway, this is a personal comment. Okay. So they just to quickly say that he was a busy man. This was 2 years before he died, and he wrote to me. Nobody.
And look what happened. So John, let's switch gears a bit and let's talk about Einstein, the icon, the love man, the Einstein, the bicycle rider, Einstein, the poet, Einstein, the man who was beloved by everyone. But you mentioned in your introductory remarks that he was not beloved by everyone, that in fact there were people who took issue with him. There were physicists who took issue with him for on scientific grounds, but there were also lots of people who took issue with him on a wider variety of issues. So perhaps you could elaborate on that a little.
Sure. Nobody's ever taken a census, of course, but I'm sure you could make a good case of the fact that he's probably as much hated numerically as he was loved. First of all, he was Jewish, and he was hated as a Jew, and is hated to this day as a Jew by many people. I remember once we had a meeting, the Triple S meeting, on the occasion of the 100th anniversary of his birth, 1879, and this discussion was going on about what role his wife, the first wife in the life of marriage, played in his work. And afterwards, a physicist, whom I didn't know, came up to me, apparently not knowing I was Jewish, and said, you know, I always knew the Jews were making too much of Einstein. This goes on to this day. So he was hated as a Jew, not just in Germany, but in the United States, too. There was plenty of anti-Semitism in the 1930s. Anybody who was around then will know that. He was hated, of course, in Germany as a pacifist during World War I. It was well known that the police actually had him on a list of the 10 leading pacifists to be kept under surveillance during the later years of the First World War. Of course, he continued to espouse the course of pacifism, even non-resistance. His famous 2% speech he made in the United States around 1930, if 2% of the men refused to serve in the military draft in every Western country, that would so clog the prison system that would break down the military draft system. But he was, he was a man of principle, but also had a certain tactical sense. When fascism came to power, he reversed gears. Though his goal, obviously, was always to end militarism, he realized pacifism as a tactic could not be employed anymore. Because if you voiced pacifist sentiment in Germany, you'd end up in a concentration camp. And if you voiced pacifism in France, England, and United States, what happened if you succeeded? You would disarm the Western democracies at a time when it was clear that fascism was heading towards war. So he felt to further his deepest goals of anti-militarism, he had to be prepared to fight fascism. So he was tactically more astute than people think. But he was hated by many pacifists in the 30s for that reason. They regarded him as a traitor to the cause. So he's hated as a Democrat, of course, in the Weimar Republic, when many people were out to overthrow the Weimar Republic. His life was literally threatened, and this was not an idle threat, because one of his friends at that time, Walter Rathenau, who was Jewish and the foreign minister, was assassinated. And Einstein had to go into hiding for a while because his life really was literally threatened. He was hated as a socialist in his later years. In the United States, he openly espoused the cause of socialism. He wrote this famous article, Why Socialism? And he pinpointed what he felt was wrong with the capitalist system and why ultimately we would have to adopt some sort of collective mode of production. On the other hand, with the example of the Soviet Union before him, he realized that just collectivizing the economy was not going to create a socialist society. It could be the basis of the most brutal totalitarianism. And therefore, he was hated by many communists because he spoke out against the communist system. So there were many, many reasons why he was a hated person. He was a man of principle, and that's the thing that we must admire most about him. I remember when I was in my younger years, in the early 50s, when McCarthyism was rampant in the United States, he was such a treasured figure to me because he was one of the few intellectuals who spoke out. He didn't bend his back and retreat and backtrack. He said, you must defend your right to hold your opinions. At that time, communists were saying, if you're called upon to testify, use the Fifth Amendment, your right against self-incrimination. So this idea of Fifth Amendment communists came out. You must have something to hide if you use the Fifth Amendment. Einstein said, no, you should use the First Amendment, which says Congress has no right to inquire into your political beliefs at all. And if you have to go to jail for that, he said, I would be willing to go to jail. And that's the kind of man that Einstein was.
Thanks. Lee.
And that's why he was hated.
Thanks, John. Let's get back to physics for a bit, Lee. Let me ask you a question. I'm going to push you a little bit. I tried asking you this before, and you were very diplomatic.
I have a story too, but you first, and then I'll come back to you. Yeah.
So let's do a thought experiment. So we resurrect Einstein. He comes back. He comes back that's the question. So he comes back as the man he was shortly before he died, with all his faculties in place, and we'll give him, I don't know, 5-10 minutes or so to get caught up on what's happened in the last 50 years, theoretical physics. He can maybe listen to a few of John's talks. And then we say, okay, Albert, here you are. Here's a room at Perimeter Institute where we're willing to, even though we don't give tenure, we're still willing to
hire him.
A trial basis.
And what would he be working on? What would he do? What sort of physics would he find captivating that's going on right now?
You're pushing me to do... Fine, I'll do it. Okay. I think that what Einstein was most concerned with was, first of all, quantum theory. He said he'd spent many more times in his life worrying about quantum theory and the meaning of quantum theory than he ever devoted to general relativity. And I think he would still be worrying about quantum theory and foundations of quantum theory. He was interested in unification, and that is certainly one thing that has taken off, this idea of a unified field theory. Let me tell my story about that, because I think it illuminates how he was misunderstood or unappreciated. When I went as a postdoc, my first academic posting to Princeton, to the Institute for Advanced Study, and one of the professors there was Freeman Dyson, who people may know the name of, a very imaginative, wide-ranging thinker. And Freeman is also a gentleman, and came by my office after a few days and invited me to lunch. And over lunch he said, is everything okay? Is housing okay? Everything is... And is there anything I can do to help you be more comfortable here in Princeton? And I said, well, everything's fine, but I do have one question that I'm dying to ask you. And he said, sure, anything. And I said, what was Einstein really like? And he said, I'm sorry, I can't help you. And I said, what do you mean you can't help me? And he said, I never met him. And I said, how is it possible? You came here in 1947, I think, as a professor, and Einstein lived till 1955. You were colleagues for 8 years here. It's a small place. There are only 5 or 6 professors, after all. How is it possible you never met him? And he said, well, I'll tell you. He said, I felt the same as you when I came here. I wanted to know what Einstein was like. So I went to Helen Dukas, his secretary, and I made an appointment to have tea with him on Friday. And on Thursday, I got nervous. What should I discuss with Einstein? This story is also very much about Freeman. He got nervous, and so he went to Helen Dukas and asked for some of Einstein's papers so he could study them and have something to talk about. And so he got these papers, and he took them home, and they were on Einstein's efforts to make a unified field theory. And he realized, he said, as he read them that night, that they were junk, in his words. Okay. And then he woke up in the morning terrified because he realized that he couldn't face Einstein and tell Einstein that he, Freeman Dyson, this young guy, thought that what he was doing was junk. On the other hand, also being Freeman, he couldn't see Einstein and not say that. So he called and apologized that he was sick, and he spent the next 8 years avoiding Einstein until he died. And I think that is partly about Freeman, but it's an attitude that many people had at the time. And I said to him, but Freeman, didn't you understand that Einstein, certainly he could have defended himself. Wouldn't have been the first time he heard that people thought that what he was doing was useless. He was a pretty smart guy. He was pretty experienced. Certainly he would have had to say something. He would have had something to say to defend himself. And Freeman looked at me sort of sadly, and he said, yes, but you know, I was much older before I realized that, and by then he was dead.
John.
By the way, if anyone wants to really understand Einstein's Titanic work, I would say Brown Pies' book is the best one to look at for that. Yeah. But on this question of what would Einstein be most
disturbed
about?
Sorry to interrupt. This is Subtle as the Lord, is the title of the book that John's referring to.
I think what Einstein would most be concerned about if he were resurrected would be quantum entanglement. Because he had this idea based on his work in general relativity that space-time structure is the most crucial thing, and that if two regions are so far separated in space and time that it's impossible for a signal to communicate between the two regions because the velocity of light gives you the maximum signal velocity, so such regions are possible, that there could be no connection between the two. And yet quantum theory, quantum mechanics has developed, showed there was such an entanglement. And indeed, one of his most important papers in his later years was the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paper, precisely devoted to bringing out this feature of quantum entanglement. And he couldn't reconcile himself with that. Everybody knows this phrase, God doesn't play dice. But I think Einstein would have adapted to the probabilistic nature of quantum mechanics if it hadn't been for this quantum entanglement feature, this which he regarded as the spooky aspect of quantum mechanics was the entanglement. And yet we know today as a result of the aspect experiment that this feature actually exists. Einstein was a realist, he would have accepted that. How he would have reconciled himself to that, I think, would be the most interesting thing to know about how Einstein would have reacted to physics.
I think in Raymond Laplan's lab, just over there, you're entangling atoms all the time as a regular basis.
Indeed, all throughout the world. John, I wanted to ask you a question a little bit more sociological in nature. So many people have commented on how Einstein is somewhat was outside of the mainstream, and perhaps that gave him some impetus to a fresh look at physics to cause a revolution. Are we doing enough today to create the climate to produce another Einstein? Are we doing enough academically to be able to give the conditions such that somebody else can come along like Einstein? And if we're not, what should we be doing differently?
Well, that's an interesting question. We live in a different time. And let me illustrate why I say that, because when Einstein was working in 1905, as I mentioned earlier, he was a civil servant in a patent office. He was outside academia. And if he submitted a paper to a journal now, he would have used yahoo.com or hotmail.com as an address. And do we have an archive of electronic papers, which we use to great extent to communicate our physics? This is before the papers are actually published in journals. And these archives do not accept papers with the address of hotmail.com. So I feel that today, if Einstein had submitted his five papers to the Physical Review Letters, they would have been rejected. Planck, I have to get back to this, but Planck was one of the editors of the Annales de Physique in 1905. And he wasn't doing day-to-day activities about it, the actual editing. But he didn't like Einstein's idea of a quantum of energy. But they still published his paper. This would not happen today. I'm convinced of that. So this is one aspect of how science is done today, and it's a serious issue. There are a lot of people who have, if I may use the word, crazy ideas. And so Einstein was considered weird, you know, even by the people who had him employed in the patent office. And weird people are not easily received as far as publication is concerned. So even later in years, he was still faced with challenges. When he was working on his theory of gravitation, he ran into serious problems in developing his theory. It's a very difficult and interesting process, how he developed his gravity theory. And Max Planck was not happy about what he was doing. So when he was made professor in Berlin at Max Planck's Institute, in those days they gave public lectures when introducing the professor. And Planck introduced Albert Einstein and went through his work in 1905 and finally got to what he was doing today. And he said, personally, I said, I think that Professor Einstein is wasting his time working on gravitation. And in fact, only recently he published a paper with his collaborator Marcel Grossman where they proved that you cannot do what he's doing, and words to that effect. And Einstein, of course, is sitting in the front row, and he just ignored this and continued. So one of the aspects of Einstein as a scientist was that he had enormous tenacity when he was engaged in solving a problem. He just continued with tenacity until he finally felt that he resolved the issues. And this is a very unusual characteristic of thinking, and most of us don't have that ability. Most of us, if Planck, the director, the boss, had said this publicly, we would quit, but he didn't.
Oh, really? You'd quit if... That's interesting. I don't believe that for a moment, John.
I wouldn't quit.
Lee has one thing to say, and then I'd like to switch gears a little bit more. So
I only want to disagree with one thing. I think the question is an issue. Opening up the university and science to people with that kind of courage and imagination is an important goal. There aren't very many, so it wouldn't be very hard to do, and we should do more. And Perimeter is part, in my view, of doing more. But I disagree with John on one thing. I think the papers would be published. And I think the right way to ask the question, because it's very easy to blame the system, to blame the organization of science and so forth. Okay, if I got a paper, okay, which ignored my life's work, okay, and took the key questions in a different direction, and was 5 or 6 pages long and went crisply like that, the way that John described, you know, each one is like a little Thelonious Monk piece or something, just psht, and it's over. Have the insight to accept that paper? Okay. I think that's the more interesting question. And my answer is, I hope so.
I think so. I think that's probably the first time ever Einstein's papers have been described as a series of little Thelonious Monk pieces. Is that the first time that's happened?
To my knowledge.
Yeah.
I want to take issue with one thing. Einstein was not regarded as weird at the patent office. Einstein came from a family which was involved in electrotechnical business. His uncle was designing and patenting dynamos and electric meters. This is a milieu, he grew up in a technological milieu. The patent office was not a strange place for him to be. His cast of mind was primarily thinking in terms of visual and muscular images, he tells us. Patent office work was fine for him.
And he had some of his own.
The only problem was he could do in four hours an 8-hour day's work, as his son-in-law says in his biography, and therefore he learned very quickly to do his 4 hours work, then get out his papers and work on them, always being ready to show them in the drawer if somebody came around to see what he was doing. And he coined this wonderful phrase for the recipe for success. Success is equal to X plus Y plus Z, where X is work, Y is play, and Z is keep your mouth shut.
did he not have a few patents of his own?
Of course. Throughout his life, he patented things with and got some money for some of the patents, by the way. He collected royalties on a number of patents. And he was called in as a patent expert in some very extremely important patent cases after he'd gotten the Nobel Prize in physics. So this was part of his life. He could do this easily because that was the way he thought. It was not, he was not impractical. That's another myth about him. If you mean by practicality, solvency, concerned with money, he was impractical. If you mean by practicality, ability to deal with technological issues, he was as practical as any physicist I know.
I think John's point, so I want to switch gears again, but I think John's central point, if I may take the liberty of saying this, is the tenacity that Einstein had and his simple unwillingness to not give up and follow through on his principles and follow through on his ideals from a scientific perspective, as well as from a moral perspective. Let me switch gears a little bit, last question before I throw it open to the audience, and talk about Einstein and religion. Much has been discussed about Einstein and religion and his sense of religion, and he wrote somewhat extensively for a general public on religion. So maybe, John, perhaps you can enlighten us a little bit more with his views on religion and whether or not they were controversial.
He was once asked, he was accused of being an atheist, and some rabbi telegraphed him from the United States, do you believe in God? He said, I believe in the God of Spinoza. Well, if you know what the God of Spinoza is, Spinoza says it's God, that is nature. So Einstein called his religious views cosmic religion. And for him, that was the warrant that the universe is comprehensible. He says the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it is comprehensible. And that is what cosmic religion meant to him, this certainty that if nature poses a problem to us, there is an answer. And if you don't find the answer, it's your fault, not nature's fault. That's what enabled him to work for 10 years on the special theory of relativity, for almost 10 years on the general theory of relativity, and for the rest of his life on unified field theory without coming to any final conclusion to his own satisfaction, let alone to that of the physics community. So religion to him was the comprehensibility, the assurance of the comprehensibility of nature, that no puzzles posed by nature were insoluble. They just couldn't be solved by you, perhaps, or something, but that was your fault, not nature's fault. Religion for him had nothing to do with an anthropomorphic God. He thought moral issues, for example, were the most important human issues, but they were purely human affairs. They did not need some supernatural warrant. The fact that they were necessary for the survival and flourishing of a human community was enough for the moral questions to be central in his thinking. So he was not religious in the conventional sense, in this sense of believing in one could say the harmony of the spheres, that the universe is lawful and comprehensible. In that sense, he was deeply religious.
Was that controversial at all? Were members of the theological community in any sense upset or incensed at the fact that he would write about religion to a popular audience, or his view of religion, or did that provoke no real controversy among the theological community?
As far as I know, no, it didn't. But I think he's often misinterpreted as if he were conventionally religious, and some of his statements are twisted out of context. But for example, he was friendly with Rabbi Stephen Wise, one of the leading Jewish theological figures of the time. And he saw no conflict. In fact, he saw no conflict between the various religions. One of his most beautiful statements, he was in that sense more like an 18th century rationalist. If he said if you could combine the best in the teachings of Jesus, of Moses, of Buddha, of all the religions, you would have a basis for, combined with what's deep and meaningful in all of them, you have a basis for human morality. But you shouldn't try to attach any significance to the sectarian dogmas which divide them. You should look for the common basis of all religions, which is morality.
No, I think I'm going to cut it off here, and I'm going to turn it over to a question over here on the right side.
The theory of general relativity is based on a rather complicated mathematics by Riemann, and Hilbert said any mathematician at the time would know more about it than Einstein did, yet Einstein, using physical ideas, came to the theory of general relativity before any of the mathematicians did. So my question is essentially, how did he do that, and is there insight in how he did that to solving the unified theory? That is, rather than looking at the complicated mathematics of string theory, what are the physical ideas that need to be brought in order to make progress in string theory?
I'll give this to John Stachel.
Einstein had, well, that was the second great question of the three questions. He had this great insight that the equality of inertial and gravitational mass was the key to the understanding of gravity. That one cannot separate inertia and gravitation, that they're just two sides of the same coin, and that the separation depends on your state of motion. Just like in an electromagnetic case, what you see in an electric field and what you see in a magnetic field depends on your state of motion. In that case, it depends on your velocity. In case of the inertial gravitational field, it depends on your acceleration. So we had this deep conceptual insight right from the beginning and held on to that right through to the end. It's often said he found the mathematical tools he needed to implement this idea ready to hand. That is not correct. He did not have a basic concept of the affine connection, which was the correct representation today of the inertial gravitational field. And as soon as this concept was developed, Einstein realized that, and realized that that was the central missing link. But Einstein was not Newton. Newton could feel the need for the mathematics and create the mathematics. He needed differential calculus. He did it. He needed integral calculus. He did it. Einstein could see the need, but he didn't have the ability to create the new mathematics. As I said in that quote I flashed by, he didn't have that feeling of what was really important in mathematics that he felt he had in physics. So he had to make do with the tools that he had, and that is the reason why, basically, it took him 2.5, 3 years from the time he got the basic insight that he should represent gravitation by a metric tensor field, doesn't matter the details, by a certain mathematical structure, to getting the correct field equation to describe that structure, because he didn't have the mathematical tools to hand that he needed. So what lesson can we draw from that? It's hard to say that you've got to have the right mathematical tools. That's certainly one lesson you could draw from it. And also that physical insights are not necessarily connected with mathematical insights in the same person. And I think it's very important we have cooperation and collaboration between the mathematics and the physics community, the kind of thing that existed and was taken for granted in the 19th century, but has become so rare in our time.
Okay. I'm just going to throw one more question, and then I'm going to give you each a very brief opportunity to sum up.
Okay, my question is, Einstein thought about space and time and quantum mechanics. Should we be thinking of space and time as continuous, or did Einstein ever think that space and time are themselves quantized?
Well, that's the point I was making. There was another, what I call the other Einstein, the Einstein who felt that the whole problem with unified field theory not succeeding might be that we're taking continuum as the basis, and that we should have what sometimes called the purely algebraic physics, some sort of combinatorial structure, which would therefore be based on discrete ideas. And of course, people today are working on these things, people like Raphael Sorkin working on causal set theory. So this alternative existed in Einstein's mind. He never said much about it in public because he didn't have a concrete example. And as I said, Einstein didn't like to just pray it on. He would do that in his letters, but if you're going to say something in public, you better have the goods. And he never had the goods, but he was always looking for the goods. Somebody who worked in intuitionistic mathematics once described the conversation with Einstein. He said he was amazed Einstein was so interested in what he was doing. And I immediately realized why, because Einstein thought maybe this is going to give him the basis for this combinatorial approach that he felt could be used if he had a mathematical tool to create some new physical theory.
At this point, I'd like to turn to our panelists and ask them to do a very, very brief summing up. So in 2 or 3 sentences, we'll... Perhaps each of you can say just a few words on the impact of Einstein's legacy and what it means for you personally in your work. Lee.
Well, Einstein is such an inspiration, and I agree, and much of my own work has been based on implementing this idea that perhaps space and time are discrete, and we've had some success. And sometimes one can feel proud of that, but I think measured against what Einstein was able to do, one ends up feeling is harder than it looked, harder than it looked it would be. And but I'm very sure we'll succeed, and I'm very sure that there will be a close to the revolution that Einstein started. And I don't think it'll come before dinner, but I hope it comes soon. Thank you.
John.
Einstein's kept me busy since I was 19 years old. And he still keeps me busy. I just wanted to address the issue of one of the questions. That Einstein had a deep well of physical intuition. And this is why he was a great physicist. And he had the ability to have these simple thoughts about the world like a child, and have these simple ideas about an elevator falling, a man falling off a roof, which gave him the idea of the equivalence principle, which is the basic principle of his gravitational theory. And this is what's missing in unified theory work. There is no basic principle underlying these ideas at present. So, well, he keeps us busy.
challenge reminds you of Peanut Strip, where Charlie Brown is reading a book. He reads it out loud. Once there was a man, he was born, he lived, he dies. And he says, what a book, it has everything. But what I've gotten from Einstein is general relativity was the key thing that influenced me. And general relativity forces you to do two things. You have to displace your emphasis from things to processes. It's not so much things changing in time as processes of totality that you have to think about. And also you have to think about relational structures as crucial, that the relations, in a sense, determine the properties of things more than the things determine the properties of relations. And it's an attempt to implement these kind of things that I think will lead to great success in the future. And I only agree with you about these things because you can read it all in this book, which I again recommend to you, Three Roads to Quantum Gravity.
Thank you.
You shouldn't have too much self-promotion among panelists. Right. it's not
but, of course, the other thing is the human values that Einstein brought. I wish we could say his political and social views were history. They're not, and that's why we need Einstein as our friend and ally if we're going to succeed in this world, and if there is going to be a world to leave to our children and grandchildren. I'm going to pass away, and this won't matter to me, but I have children and grandchildren. It's their fate I'm worried about, and I think every one of us has to take this to heart.
Once again, I'd like to thank all the panelists for a very stimulating and engaging evening. Thank you all very much.